The following is distributed by the Berean Call.
Welcome. You're listening to the audio version of the Berean Call newsletter. I'm Tom McMahon, TBC's Executive Director. This month's feature article titled, Cry Out for Liberty, was written by and will be read by Dave Hunt. And now, here's Dave.
Thanks, Tom. God promised that the Messiah, who would redeem mankind from Satan's power and sin's penalty, would be a virgin-born Jew. Genesis 3:15, Genesis 12:3, Isaiah 7:14, Isaiah 9:6, and so forth, who would reign forever on King David's throne in Jerusalem. To defeat God, Satan must inspire the annihilation of the Jews. Anti-Semitism, the satanically inspired persecution and slaughter of Jews like no other people all through history, was foretold in the Bible. Deuteronomy 28:37, Jeremiah 29:17-19, and many other places. Rome's destruction of Jerusalem in A.D. 70, 1.2 million killed, was followed in A.D. 135 with 985 towns wiped out and 580,000 slain. The situation eased under some Caesars, worsened under others. Constantine, he lived from 280 to 337, briefly granted Judaism equal status with other religions. But after becoming a, quote, Christian, unquote, he oppressed the Jews. Succeeding Roman emperors continued the persecution. The popes, successors to the Roman emperors, continued the oppression. Inspired by Pope Urban II, 1096, crusaders murdered Jews all along their route and in taking the Holy Land. Church councils such as Vienna, 1311, Zamora, 1313, and Basel, 1431 through 33, strengthened anti-Semitism as official Roman Catholic doctrine. More than 100 anti-Semitic church documents were published between the 6th and 20th centuries. During the church-dominated Middle Ages, Jews were driven out of nearly every European nation, including England. Where could they go with no country of their own? Somehow they clung to life, confined to ghettos. Islam's founder, Muhammad, he lived from 570 to 632 AD, killed every Jew in Arabia except for the few who escaped. In North Africa and Middle Eastern countries, following the Muslim conquest in the 7th century, there was endless brutalization, pillaging, and massacre of Jews. As the Romans had done with Jerusalem in AD 135, any city designated a, quote, holy city of Islam, unquote, such as Kairouan in Tunisia in the 13th century, was made Jew-free. What Islam modeled was repeated in Nazi Germany as one village or city after another was declared Judenfrei. In the German elections of May 1928, the Nazi Party, aided by Vatican funds given to Hitler by Cardinal Eugenio Pacelli, who later became Pope Pius XII, gained its first 12 seats in the Reichstag. From that time, a reign of terror spread across Germany that would enslave Europe. On January 1, 1930, Hitler's stormtrooper terrorists killed 8 Jews, the first victims of the Nazi era. Jews were molested in public places and synagogue services were constantly interrupted. In the 1930 elections, with Hitler's brown shirts intimidating voters, the Nazi seats rose from 12 to 107. On January 30, 1933, a political compromise made Hitler, then 43 years of age, Germany's chancellor. He swiftly established a Nazi dictatorship with no dissent allowed. Mein Kampf had promised an end to the Jews, who were now beaten in the streets, their stores looted, then boycotted. The reaction outside Germany was brief and muted. Mass rallies were held in New York's Madison Square Garden, Paris's Trocadero, and London's Queen Hall to protest Germany's growing anti-Jewish pogroms. but an uncaring world turned a blind eye to the Holocaust, which still haunts all who have a conscience. By 1934, the campaign to create Jew-free villages was spreading. Jews were driven out of all professions and education. In the growing terrorism, stormtroopers would enter a village, smash and loot Jewish shops, trample the Torah in the synagogue, and assault and kill Jews in the streets. Frightened and bewildered Jews fled to neighboring towns, only to be expelled again, and eventually taken to extermination camps. For centuries, Jews had been fleeing Europe to return to their ancient land. There, in the 1920s and 30s, funded by the Nazis and aided by British peacekeepers, anti-Jewish riots were led by Haj Amin al-Husseini, Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, terrorist, friend and admirer of Hitler and Himmler, Arafat's great uncle, mentor and model. The Mufti, to whom Hitler on November 21, 1941, promised a solution for the Jewish problem, similar to what he was pursuing in Germany, was personally responsible for the concentration camp slaughter of hundreds of thousands of Jews. During World War II, Haj Amin fled to Berlin, from which place he broadcast, quote, "Arabs, rise as one man and slaughter the Jews wherever you find them. This pleases Allah." Jews fought on the side of the Allies. The Arabs joined Hitler. As a reward, he promised to exterminate the Jews in their countries, as he was doing in Europe. But in February 1945, when Allied victory was certain, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Syria, and Lebanon declared war on Germany, an act required before March 1, 1945, by any country that desired to join the newly organized United Nations. On November 29, 1947, after 6 million Jews had perished, a briefly conscience-stricken UN in Resolution 181 gave them 18% of the ancient land of Israel, misnamed Palestine, all of which the League of Nations, recognizing its historical connection to the Jewish people, had allotted for their national homeland. The mandate for Palestine, June 24, 1922, was to be administered by Britain under the Balfour Declaration. Unhappy with being given 82% of what the world had admitted belonged to the Jews, and demanding it all, employing outside forces and arms from Arab states as distant as Iraq, Arabs rioted, plundered, and murdered Jews, encouraged by the British, who were hoping for an excuse to abandon their mandate to establish the Jewish homeland. Britain's betrayal of the Jews beginning in the 1920s in favor of the oil-rich Arabs brought about the end of its empire, on which the sun never sank. Another fulfillment of God's warning, "I will curse him that curseth thee," Genesis 12:3. Something worse than Nazism was rising, an Arab religion called Islam, which centuries before had forcefully conquered most of the world. This time, its monopoly of oil was its major weapon. When Israel declared its independence in May 1948, it was instantly attacked by the regular armies of 6 Muslim nations, whose leaders publicly vowed to annihilate every Jew. Azam Pasha, Secretary General of the Arab League, promised, quote, "This will be a war of extermination," unquote. Palestine, so-called, like Arabia, was to be made Jew-free. Muslim leaders, both political and religious, more openly than Hitler, repeatedly call for the extermination of all Jews. You will get some details on that in our Q&A, May 2002. Islam requires the death of all Jews before its last day judgment can occur. On November 23, 1937, Saudi Arabia's King Ibn Saud said, quote, "For a Muslim to kill a Jew ensures him an immediate entry into heaven," unquote. PLO leader Farouk Kaddoumi vowed, quote, "This Zionist ghetto of Israel must be destroyed," unquote. Palestinians marching in support of Saddam Hussein's invasion of Kuwait chanted, "Saddam, you hero, attack Israel with chemical weapons." An Arabic translation of Mein Kampf is a bestseller today in Palestinian Authority territory. Textbooks in Syria lead pupils to the inevitable conclusion that all Jews must be annihilated. Calls for annihilation of Jews still resound throughout the Muslim world, such as the Friday sermon in Gaza's Zayed bin Sultan al-Nayan Mosque, October 14, 2000, by Ahmad Abu Halabia. Quote, "The Jews must be butchered. Have no mercy. Kill them and those Americans who established Israel here in the beating heart of the Arab world," unquote. Sheikh Ibrahim Mahdi vowed in a sermon on Palestinian television June 8, 2001, quote, "Allah willing, Israel will be erased. The United States will be erased. Britain will be erased. Blessings to whoever put a belt of explosives on his body or on his sons and plunged into the midst of the Jews," unquote. Incredibly, Zionism, the belief that Jews have a right to their national homeland, was condemned as racism by UN General Assembly Resolution 3379 on November 10, 1975. 16 long years later, December 16, 1991, that vote was finally reversed over Muslim protests. Yet Zionism is still a capital crime in Iraq. Few, whether Jews or their enemies, acknowledge that the Middle East conflict involves the last day's reestablishment of God's chosen people in the land he promised to them. Today's events were foretold in biblical prophecies that validate the Bible beyond dispute as God's word. As prophesied, Israel has become what President Eisenhower called, quote, "the most strategically important area in the world," unquote. When it became a nation once again, about 800,000 Jews, nearly double the number of original so-called Palestinian refugees, fled to Israel from the horror they had long endured in Muslim countries. Here is the tally of Jews in various countries in 1948 and today. Algeria, 140,000. Today, 75. Egypt, 75,000. Today, 200. Iraq, 150,000. Today, 100. Lebanon, 20,000. Today, 50. Libya, 38,000. Today, none. Morocco, 265,000. Today, 5,800. Syria, 30,000. Today, 150. Tunisia, 105,000. Today, 1,500. Yemen and Aden, 63,000. Today, 150, and so forth. Following the Six-Day War in 1967, the UN Security Council determined to investigate the treatment of Jews in Arab countries. Syria, Iraq, and Egypt, however, refused to allow entrance of the investigative commission. We now look back with disbelief and shame upon the Nazi era and the barbaric determination to exterminate a race. In contrast, the Islamic world looks back with approval. Their only regret today is that Hitler didn't finish his intended annihilation of all Jews. As Egyptian newspaper columnist Ahmad Ragab wrote, quote, "Thanks to Hitler, blessed memory. Although we do have a complaint, his revenge on the Jews was not enough," unquote. At the same time, much of the Muslim world denies the Holocaust. As University of Gaza history lecturer Dr. Issam Sisalem declared, quote, "They are all lies, no Dachau, no Auschwitz. The Holocaust was against our people," unquote. God created man in his own image, Genesis 1, 26-27, with the capacity to choose whether to love and obey God or to rebel against him. God desires our willing obedience in love, but love cannot be forced. Liberty to choose is essential for love. Seeking to win man's heart, God pleads, "Come now, and let us reason together." Isaiah 1:18. In contrast, Satan enslaved man with lies. "Whosoever committeth sin is the servant of sin," says John 8:34. Tyrants enslave their fellows. The worst offense of the Caesars, the Popes, the Muhammads, and Hitlers, and all who still follow their example, is not the enslavement of flesh and blood, but the tyrannical attempt to conquer the human soul and spirit. There is no reasoning with tyrants. There is not one Muslim country where basic God-given liberties are enjoyed. Saudi Arabia abstained from the International Declaration of Human Rights, adopted December 10, 1948, by the United Nations. An Islamic Declaration of Human Rights was adopted by Muslim nations on September 19, 1981. The so-called rights it offers are all according to Sharia. That's Islamic law, exactly as the Taliban practiced it. And the Sunnah, that's the example and way of life of the Prophet. Saudi Arabia, Islam's holy land, has accomplished what Nazi Germany aimed for, a Jew-free country. In obedience to Islam's founding Prophet Muhammad, no Jew is allowed in Saudi Arabia, and only Muslims can be citizens. This is Nazism resurrected. There should be an international cry of outrage, yet there is silence. Any question as to whether the hijackers, the Taliban, and suicide bombers are fanatics or real Muslims is easily dispelled, as is the delusion spread by President Bush and other political and religious leaders that Islam, quote, is peace and tolerance, unquote. One need only look at Saudi Arabia. There stands Islam's holiest site, the Kaaba in Mecca, to which each Muslim must make a pilgrimage, a Hajj, once in his lifetime. There Islam began, is headquartered, and demonstrated. In Saudi Arabia, one may see what daily life would be like in America and Europe if Islam could fulfill its goal of taking over the world. A woman cannot drive a car or even leave her home without her husband's permission and a male relative to escort her. No non-Muslim place of worship or any public expression that does not agree with Islam is allowed. To question Islam is a crime, and for a Muslim to convert to any other religion carries the death penalty. This is not fanaticism. It is Islam. Muhammad said, quote, "Whoever relinquishes his faith, kill him," unquote. Upon Muhammad's death, thousands of Arabs attempted to abandon Islam, into which they had been forced by the sword. In the wars of apostasy, tens of thousands of former Muslims, all Arabs, were killed in bringing Arabia back under Islam. All Muslims ought to be ashamed. The leadership of Saudi Arabia ought to be ashamed. How can Muslim countries sit in the United Nations and talk of freedom when they won't allow it? How can Muslims take advantage of the liberties in the free world to build their mosques and worship freely, to speak out against any who disagree with them, while knowing in their hearts that the religion they promote would suppress those very liberties if it took over? This is hypocrisy of the highest order. For years, there has been an ongoing holocaust in Muslim countries. More than 2 million non-Muslims, mostly Christians, have been killed in Indonesia, Nigeria, Sudan, and elsewhere, with hundreds of churches destroyed. Must we wait until this Islamic holocaust reaches 6 million? There ought to be an immediate international cry of outrage and revulsion. We are including with this tape names and addresses of political, media, and religious leaders. We ask all of our listeners to contact as many of them as you can with a letter of protest. Let us act before any more are slaughtered.
I'm Gary Carmichael with this month's quotable from E.H. Broadbent. The spread of the churches in the early 17th century in Austria and the surrounding states was marvelous. The accounts of the numbers put to death and of their sufferings are terrible. Yet there never failed to be men willing to take up the dangerous work of evangelists and elders. While some were being martyred, the others who were waiting their turn sang and waited with joy the death which was theirs when the executioner took them in hand. Such steadfastness constantly aroused astonishment as to the source of their strength. Roman Catholic and Reformed churches attributed it to Satan. Other believers said, "They have drunk of the water that flows from the sanctuary of God, from the well of life. God helped them to bear the cross, and they have overcome the bitterness of death." From E.H. Broadbent, The Pilgrim Church, page 173. And now Dave Hunt responds to questions from readers in this month's Q&A. Dave, our first question. I wrote to you to point out that you were in error in saying that in 1948, the Arabs broadcast orders to the Palestinians that they should flee their homeland. I sent you documentation showing no such broadcast ever took place. Since that time, you have released a video entitled Israel, Islam, and Armageddon, which repeats the same lie. All of us can make a mistake, but I have a real problem when someone takes the time to politely write to you and supply documentation pointing out a factual error in your materials, and yet you go on repeating the same errors. Sorry, but if you have to spread lies in order to make your point on the Palestine question, then your opinions do not carry any weight with me. As a Christian bookstore owner, I have sold and promoted your books over the years. But based on your use of demonstrated falsehoods to prove your points, I have to question the reliability and accuracy of everything you have published. I do not intend to purchase any more of your books for my bookstore. I suspect that this is the only type of protest that you and your organization would understand.
Here is only part of the proof that I did not spread lies about the Arab radio broadcasts. On April 22, 1948, Aubrey Lippincott, U.S. Consul General in Haifa, stated that, quote, "local mufti-dominated Arab leaders were urging all Arabs to leave the city, and large numbers did so," unquote. You'll find that in Foreign Relations of the U.S., 1948, Volume 5, page 838. The Economist, October 2, 1948, reported, quote, "Of the 62,000 Arabs who formerly lived in Haifa, not more than 5,000 or 6,000 remained. Various factors influenced their decision to seek safety and flight. The most potent were the announcements made over the air by the higher Arab executive urging all Arabs to leave, and that those Arabs who remained in Haifa and accepted Jewish protection would be regarded as renegades," unquote. New York Times, May 3, 1948, reported that, quote, "The mass evacuation, prompted partly by fear, partly by orders of Arab leaders, left the Arab quarter of Haifa a ghost city," unquote. Middle Eastern Studies, January 1986, reported that the Arab National Committee to Jerusalem ordered women, children, and the elderly in various parts of Jerusalem to leave their homes and warned, quote, "Any opposition to this order is an obstacle to the holy war and will hamper the operations of the fighters in these districts," unquote. Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri Said declared, quote, "We will smash the country Arabs should conduct their wives and children to safe areas until the fighting has died down, unquote. You find that in The Coming Destruction of Israel by Myron Kaufman. The publisher is the American Library, Inc., 1970, pages 26 and 27. Syrian Prime Minister Khaled al-Azm admitted, quote, "Since 1948, we have been demanding the return of the refugees, but we ourselves are the ones who encourage them to leave," unquote. You'll find that in the memoirs of Khaled al-Azm, published in Beirut in 1973, Part 1, pages 386 to 87. On April 3, 1949, Near East Broadcasting Station of Cyprus said, quote, "The Arab Higher Committee encouraged the refugees' flight," unquote. You find that in Samuel Katz, Battleground, Fact and Fantasy in Palestine, Bantam Books, 1985, page 15. The Jordanian newspaper, Philistine, February 19, 1949, reported, quote, "The Arab states encouraged the Palestine Arabs to leave their homes temporarily in order to be out of the way of the Arab invasion armies," unquote. Another Jordanian newspaper, Ad Diofa, September 6, 1954, quoted a complaining refugee, quote, "The Arab government told us, get out so that we can get in. So we got out, but they did not get in," unquote. According to the New York Lebanese paper, Al-Hoda, June 8, 1951, quote, "The Secretary General of the Arab League, Azam Pasha, gave brotherly advice to the Arabs of Palestine to leave their land, homes, and property, and to stay temporarily in neighboring fraternal states, lest the guns of the invading Arab armies mow them down," unquote. Further similar documentation can be found. You based your information on a 32-page booklet by a Jewish but anti-Israel group that there was, quote, "theft of real estate and personal property from the Palestinian Arabs by the Jews in 1948, unquote. Shouldn't you at least question this assertion, considering the fact that it was the Arabs who attacked the Jews? The Arabs refused to accept the UN partition of so-called Palestine, even though it gave them 82% of the territory, all of which the League of Nations and Allied victors of World War I had promised to Israel. The regular armies of six Arab nations attacked the new state of Israel with the declared intention of annihilating all Jews. The Jews did not attack the Arabs. That fact should help to evaluate Arab claims about theft of real estate and personal property. The Arabs publicly threatened to take every square yard of Israel belonging to the Jews and to kill every one of them. Did that booklet mention these facts? In contrast to Arab vows to annihilate the Jews and take all of the land, as Islam requires, Haifa's British police chief, A.J. Bridmead, reported in April 1948, quote, "Every effort is being made by the Jews to persuade the Arab population to remain," end of quote. The New York Times of April 23, 1948, reported a foreign visitor's observation, quote, "In Tiberias, I saw a placard affixed to a sealed Arab mosque that read, quote, 'We did not dispossess them. The day will come when the Arabs will return. Let no citizen touch their property,'" unquote. It was signed by the Jewish Town Council of Tiberias. Did your source give such facts? Never have the Jews threatened to wipe out Arabs. The Palestinians would have had their state had they not attacked the Jews and refused to recognize the right of Israel to exist and rejected every peaceful solution ever offered. On April 4, 1988, Time commented, quote, "Had Egypt, Syria, and the other Arab nations accepted Israel's right to exist in 1947, the Palestinians could have been living for the past 40 years in a state of their own," unquote. During the 19 years in which Jordan held East Jerusalem and the West Bank, and Egypt held the Gaza Strip, that was 1948 through 67, there was never a word about a, quote, Palestinian state, unquote. Why didn't the Arabs form that state then? Instead, they put the refugees in pitiful camps and have kept them there ever since. The truth is that there were twice as many Jewish refugees who fled Arab countries, where they had endured the most horrible treatment for 1,300 years since the advent of Islam. Israel's 650,000 settlers absorbed 800,000 refugees into normal life, but Arab nations with 700 times the land refused to absorb 400,000 refugees. Theft of real estate and personal property from the Palestinian Arabs? On the contrary, Israel's proclamation of independence issued May 14, 1948 said, quote, "In the midst of wanton aggression, we yet call upon the Arab inhabitants of the State of Israel to preserve the ways of peace and play their part in the development of the state on the basis of full and equal citizenship and due representation in all its bodies and institutions. We extend our hand in peace and neighborliness to all the neighboring states and their peoples," unquote. The response came from Azam Pasha, Secretary General of the Arab League, who said in an interview on BBC the next day, quote, "The Arabs intend to conduct a war of extermination and momentous massacre, which will be spoken of like the Mongolian massacres," unquote. Yet Israel kept its word. The Arabs who remained in Israel comprise 16% of the voters today, with full citizenship rights, and some Arabs are even members of the Knesset. In contrast, no Jew has such rights in any Arab or Muslim country, and a Jew isn't even allowed to enter Saudi Arabia.
Question. I recently discovered that Friends have become part of a growing group of professing Christians who sincerely believe that the so-called white races are the 10 lost tribes. How can I convince them otherwise?
This is a revival of the old British Israel myth based upon the unbiblical idea of 10 lost tribes. See TBC November 92 and May 96. Anyone who wants the truth need only read 2 Kings 15 through 17 concerning the carrying away by Assyria of the 10 tribes, together with 2 Chronicles chapters 30 through 34, to see that many, if not most, of the members of those tribes had returned and took part in the revivals under Hezekiah and Josiah. Though some individuals have intermarried with Gentiles, the 10 tribes continue to this day, and not in hidden form, but recognizable as Jews, though we don't know to which tribe each person belongs. Nearly 200 years after the 10 tribes were carried into Assyria, God gave Ezekiel a vision of the future division of the promised land, quote, "according to the 12 tribes of Israel," unquote, Ezekiel 47:13. Christ told his disciples they would judge the 12 tribes of Israel, Matthew 19:28 and Luke 22:30. Paul referred to the 12 tribes as all in existence in his day, Acts 26:7, and James addressed his epistle to the 12 tribes scattered abroad, James 1:1. Ezekiel 38:39 refer to the Battle of Armageddon as involving what God calls my people Israel. The term Israel is used throughout Isaiah, Jeremiah, and Ezekiel as a designation for all 12 tribes. In Ezekiel 39:28, God declares, quote, "I caused them to be led into captivity among the heathen, but I have gathered them unto their own land and have left none of them any more there." This can only be the final gathering of every Jew left on earth back to the promised land of Israel for the Messiah's millennial reign, Matthew 24:31. As for the so-called white races, whoever that may be, being the true Jews, no one can say that the white races were taken out of the land of Israel, were scattered among the heathen, are now in the process of returning there, Ezekiel 38:12, and will at the second coming all be taken there by the angels, leaving none of them outside of Israel. There wouldn't be room for all the white races in Israel. These promises are obviously to the Jews alone.
And now, Dave, our final question this month. You have said that on Nisan 1, in the 20th year of the reign of Artaxerxes Longimanus, Nehemiah received authorization to rebuild Jerusalem, and that in keeping with Gabriel's promise, Daniel 9:25, 483 years later to the day, Jesus rode into Jerusalem on the donkey. That should have been the first of Nisan in AD 32. Yet you say it was the 10th of Nisan. Isn't this a discrepancy?
You raise an obvious point which I had never thought of before. I often say 483 years to the day, which would not be the case if Nehemiah received the authority to rebuild on Nisan 1st, because we know that Jesus had to ride into Jerusalem on Nisan 10th, the day the lambs were taken from the flock, and he had to be crucified in the evening of the 14th. Exodus 12:6. And so it happened. While it was Nisan 1st in the 20th year of Artaxerxes, Nehemiah 2:1, when Nehemiah petitioned the king, that could not be the date of the commandment to restore and to build Jerusalem, Daniel 9:25, a fact overlooked not only by me, but by Sir Robert Anderson and Josh McDowell, who quotes him in Evidence That Demands a Verdict, pages 180 to 81. It is doubtful that Artaxerxes instantly wrote out the authorization the moment Nehemiah made the request. There must have been procedures to follow that would have taken time. In verse 6 of chapter 2, Nehemiah says, "I set him a time," obviously meaning when he was going to be ready to leave for Jerusalem. No doubt the king's authorization would have carried that date. 9 days to prepare to go seems reasonable, making his departure and the date of the authorization the 10th of Nisan. Thus, Christ's triumphal entry to Jerusalem 483 years later to the day would have been on the 10th of Nisan. This is reasonable and must have been the case because Christ had to present himself to Israel on Nisan 10th, the day the Passover lambs were taken from the flock and kept for 4 days under observation before being killed on the 14th, the very day that Christ was crucified, Thursday, not Friday, as we have documented. Thanks again for bringing this to my attention.
This month's news alert comes from WorldNetDaily.com, January 14, 2003. An Israeli documentary in 1998 showed how Palestinian children are taught to hate Jews, to glorify jihad, violence, death, and child martyrdom. A Sesame Street-like children's program called The Children's Club showed very young children singing songs about wanting to become suicide warriors and to take up a machine gun to direct violence, anger against Israelis. During the show, which features children aged 4 to 10, one young boy sings, "When I wander into Jerusalem, I will become a suicide bomber." Afterward, other children stand to call for jihad, holy war to the end, against the Zionist enemy. I'm Gary Carmichael, and now, once again, here's TBC Executive Director Tom McMahon.
TBC Notes for this month addresses the subject of sorting the mail. We're thrilled to hear from you, and we enjoy reading your comments, even criticisms. They're helpful, too. Regretfully, however, we don't have the staff or the time to reply to every letter we receive. When questions are asked to which we feel a response might be helpful to our readers in general, we usually respond in our Q&A column. We know some will be disappointed at not hearing from us. Nevertheless, it's the only way we can be good stewards of our time and resources, and effectively fulfill the ministry to which the Lord has called us. I'm Tom McMahon, Executive Director of the Berean Call. Thanks for listening, and please continue to pray for Dave, the staff, and the fruitfulness of the ministry.
For more information about the Berean Call and a free subscription to our monthly newsletter, contact us at P.O. Box 7019, Bend, Oregon, 97708. Call us at 800-937-6638 or visit our website at www.thebereancall.org.